Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hey, green future growers. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener Podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get entered to get listening to your first audiobook today. Welcome to the show today. I am super, super excited to bring on this guest because she's someone Hunter Linden, I think, told me about you way back when I was first starting my podcast. I think he's like back in one of the beginning interviews. And he said, oh, you've got to check out this woman in Washington who has bees. And there's this great documentary called The Queen of the Sun. And you can just go watch that and see her in action. And then check out her website. Her and her husband have the Friendly Haven Rise Farm, which is in this little tiny town of Vennersburg in southwest Washington. They have cows and goats and chickens and turkeys and many honeybees with a bee sanctuary on the property. And they have lots of fruit trees and vegetable gardens. And they're just, I just know we're going to learn a ton today. So I'm so excited. She has a new book out she's going to tell us about. So welcome to the show, Jacqueline Freeman.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here. Oh, that's really wonderful to know that it was Hunter who pointed you towards me. Yes, yeah. He was here just this past summer helping us out on the farm.
Oh, he was. He is just such a wonderful guy. And I hear great things about him whenever I talk to anybody who knows him. And he's just really sweet. So cool. Good to hear. So do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, let's see. We've been farming for 15 years. We bought our 100-year-old farm 15 years ago, and we're the second owners. It's always been organic, although it was organic before us due to frugality rather than a political action. And then we came in, and we actually didn't intend to become farmers at all. That was not the direction we thought our life was going in. My husband works with horses, and I run a school for people who want to learn to work with horses, and that's what we thought we were doing. But once we bought this farm, we bought it because we both are from very small towns in New England, and then we moved out here to the Northwest, and we wanted to live in a small town again. And once we bought the farm, it was funny. This farm just wanted to put itself back together again and be a farm. So I got started with chickens because my neighbor down the street raises heirloom chickens, Brenda. And one day she showed up at my front door and she said, you have a farm, you should have chickens. And I said, well, okay, all right, that would be. And she said, great, because I have some in my car. And she just dropped off about a dozen chickens and then off we were. And, you know, chickens are the gateway animal on a farm. And the next year, my other friend found, she had a friend who had just sold her house in Portland and had some bees in the woods behind there in a hive. And they had long been abandoned. And she asked me if we could take them. The new owner didn't want bees in the backyard. So and it was the same thing. She said, you have a farm, you should have bees. So we said, sure, we'll take bees. Never having a clue how much that decision would change my whole life. And so we got them. The next year, I started dreaming about cows every night. And I swear to you, I had never had a thought or a dream about a cow in my life. And I started dreaming about cows every night. I'd wake up in the morning and say, cows in the field or cows in a barn. Or so I figured that was just the farm saying it wanted cows. So we went out and got a cow. And then we had more cows. And she became the mother to many. I think at maximum, we had probably 8.
Wow.
And my husband, just as we're talking, just came in from milking just now. So, different kinds of animals. Some of them are seasonal, like the turkeys, and some of them we've had dairy goats. And then, of course, my bees have turned into hundreds and thousands of honeybees.
Wow, that's quite the introduction. So started, but now, do you have horses? You must
have. No, horses. Isn't that funny? That's the one animal we don't have.
You don't.
My husband works with them all the time. And when we teach people to work with horses, he teaches them on a fresh horse. And that's the reason we don't have horses here. And I grew up with horses, so I have a many-year background, probably 30-year background with horses. But we decided not to have them here because for students, it's actually better to always have new horses so they can tell the effect of their work.
Oh, well, I guess I don't know anything about horses, so I don't, I guess I don't really. So I just get, like, you're training, like you're breaking a new horse? Like,
oh, no,
people
no, no.
who want to have
does,
a, I'm just confused.
No, he does a kind of work called structural integration on horses and teaches people how to do it as a career. His school is called the Equine Natural Movement School. And that's what it does. It brings horses back into balance and structure, and it becomes much more fluent and fluid in their movement, and just easier for them to be healthy and strong and stable and sturdy. It affects how they move in. You know, if someone shows, then it affects a great deal of the grace of their movement. So it's wonderful work. He's been doing that for, gosh, 20 years now.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's get on to the bees. I do usually start the show off talking about, like, your very first gardening experience. Now, you guys are from New England. Did you have a garden? Like, I usually, you know, when you were you a kid or an adult or?
No, I didn't. I lived in the country and I had ponies. So I was, you know, a little kid. I was a little girl and I had ponies. And that was completely what I was wrapped up in. And then horses and, you know, that never had a garden when I was little. I think one time I planted radishes and a little strip of something I dug up. And I was so surprised to see that they grew at all. I didn't know you had to water them. I was very young and they didn't grow very well. And that was kind of the end of it. And then when we moved on to the farm here, we had had a garden. We lived up in around the outskirts of Seattle for a few years. And we had started having gardens there, which was kind of fun. And then here, we put up some raised beds and we went to the local store that, well, not store, the local place where you can get compost and soil and things like that. And we have very clayish soil, so we were supplementing it. So we built these raised beds. I think we probably had 8 or 10 of them. And then we took the truck down and got some nice compost and dirt and filled up our beds. And it was funny because my husband said one of the truckloads, we probably brought back like 2 or 3 truckloads. And one of them, he said, this stuff smells funny. It doesn't smell like the other stuff. And we didn't think anything more of it. And then we planted our food and things started coming up in half the beds. And in the other half, things came up yellow and curled and obviously very damaged. And we went, what the heck is that? Why is it in those beds and not in these beds? And then an article came out in the paper that a lot of the golf courses around here take their stuff to, you know, their clippings and things that they trim off, they take them to be made into compost. You know, it's just a place where you can bring all of your branches and trees and bushes and what you pull out of the lawn clippings, and you know, you bring them in and they turn them into compost. And then they sell the compost or the three-way soil or whatever it is. And it turned out that there was a chemical that a lot of the golf courses were using that doesn't have a short half-life like most chemicals do, or like many chemicals do. It had a 2-year breakdown period. So that meant that when all of that refuse was turned into compostable material, the chemicals, the toxic chemicals in it were still active. So we had picked up one of those truckfuls of the contaminated soil. And it was a heartbreaker because there were farms around here who were organic and they too had used some of it and they lost their organic certification because now they had toxic chemicals on their soil and they had to go back and start all over from the beginning to do that, you know, to have it clean and free of chemicals for a few years before they could recertify. I was furious. I was just, wait a minute, I'm growing stuff in my backyard without chemicals, and I have chemicals all over my food. We were furious, and we were not that strong about organics back then. I mean, I knew it was better, and I wasn't using anything chemical on my garden, but I really wasn't buying organic food at that point. I didn't know enough about it. But that really, man, that politicized us. I became a radical activist at that. I was so upset that here I am growing food in my backyard on what I thought was clean soil, and it was contaminated. And had it grown and had we eaten it, we would have been putting that in our body. We were killing the soil that was in contact with it by this terrible chemical. None of the helpful bugs were alive. It was awful. And that was the turning point for us. We were like, we need to be really on top of this. If we're going to, how can we even trust that what we're buying in the store isn't also contaminated? And up until then, we had bought conventional food without thinking twice about it. Not anymore. That was a turning point for me. And from then on, we were completely organic in everything on our farm, obviously, but also in everything that I bought. I still today, if I pick up something and it says, it has one of those things saying 98% organic, I think, yeah, and 2% crap chemicals.
Wow,
I'm not going to put that on
you.
My body or in my body. So yeah, I don't want to support that industry at all.
That's not easy to do. We
had to dig it all out, and my husband took it to the dump. We didn't even just pile it somewhere else. We just said, nope, that's trash dirt, and it's got to sit there for 2 full years before it's even semi-clean. Compost can do a lot of wonderful things. It can really dismantle chemicals. But when you have something that has that long of what they call a half-life, you've got to wait it out. Mother Nature's pretty brilliant about being able to dismantle those things, but gosh, why put it on there in the first place?
Yeah, and golf courses is a big one. I know John Moore over in Australia talked about golf courses when he was on my show, and I just wish that they would, you know, go more organic and just be a little more natural. I mean, I don't really believe that they have to use all those chemicals. I refuse to believe it. And I've seen what manure's done in our yard. And like, you know, we have, I mean, total proof of concept, because we've gone from forest land, and just by, you know, one, mowing the lawn really makes it grow a lot. But then also, like, you know, when we very first started changing that terrain, we would just put some really nice, healthy manure and just sprinkle it around. And that made a big difference. And,
I
can't imagine a golf course looks any nicer.
Yeah.
And then what was I going to ask you about? Well, yeah. And just some, like, I've bought bags of organic potting soil home from some of the big box stores locally, and Mike won't put it on his plants. He's like, nope, I've used that stuff before and it's it's died on me. So just because it says organic, yeah, you got to be really careful. And then another guest I had on, this Peggy Owsley, said that she worked at one of the local nurseries for years, and she said that a lot of people have come in and had problems with horse manure that they got from people who, if it says that it's weed free, so you're always thinking, you know, you think free, chemical free, but actually if it's weed free, it means it has the chemicals on it. And she said she's had tons of people in our valley and in our area have big problems with their vegetables because they use that weed free compost, so or manure that they got from local people. So you have to be really careful.
You know, it's interesting because the marketers know what to write to make you think that this is an innocent product. You know, weed free, oh, that sounds pretty good. I don't want weeds in my garden, most people would say. And then you have to step back and go, no, how would it get weed free? You know, what would you have to put in there to make it weed free? Certainly nobody's going to go through and pull out all those little weed seeds by hand. So yeah, you've got to add something to it. We're also biodynamic, by the way. A few years after we started being organic, then we got into permaculture and loved that. And then kind of maybe 2 years after that, started learning more about biodynamics. And so we make a tremendous amount of our own. We have cows. I heard that a cow makes 80 pounds of manure a day. And I think I could look at my cows and go, yeah, pretty close to that.
Oh,
80 to 100 pounds, depending on the size of the cow. So we obviously make a great deal of compost and spread it around our soils. I had a really interesting thing happen one time. We had put in a new septic system, so we had this big ditch of a line that went all the way down from the farmhouse past some of our outbuildings and down to the south pasture where the septic tank and the leach field were. The septic tank was up closer, and then from the septic tank to the leach field, it was probably about maybe 300 feet going down a slope. And when they buried that ditch back in for the pipes, there was just a big long scar of red clay. And it was really interesting because it was towards fall, it was the end of the season, and I had two women who were here who were interning with us. And I said, you know, let's fill up the truck with some compost we've got here, and we'll just cover over. And with biodynamic compost, you don't use a lot of it. It's very potent. You just need to sprinkle like a half an inch over the surface, and it will work its way in. And so we went all the way from the house down past the outbuildings and then down that little strip towards the leach field. We ran out of the compost about, maybe 100 feet short of the leach field. So we had about 400 feet of it. And then we just said, that's close enough. We'll pick up again next year when we make some more. And then I didn't think twice about it. In the springtime, all that stuff came up, that stripe that we had just sprinkled the biodynamic compost on. It was amazing. It found every single flower seed that was in the soil. And it was like some of these seeds probably had been waiting 40 years to have something nurturing come and find them. It was absolutely beautiful. We had evening primroses, and we had asters, and we had just all kinds of beautiful flowers in this stripe going right down the middle of the field, right from the house. And then when you got to the end of where we ran out of the compost and we didn't do it, that was a red clay scar with almost nothing growing on it. And it stayed that way. After I realized that, I said, you know, I'm going to just leave this like it is, just so we can watch and see how long does it take nature to bring that back compared to when we added some of the biodynamic compost. And it probably took about 3 years, and it's spottier than what we put the biodynamic compost on. And it's quite remarkable to look at these two places side by side and see what a difference. We didn't do anything else to it except that skinny little half inch of biodynamic compost on the top of a red scar of clay. You know, when you dig up a ditch, you have a little bit of topsoil on the top, but when you put that dirt back in the ditch, you don't have that topsoil anymore. So whatever was down further in my clay bed there, it's not the most fabulous stuff for growing things in. It's good soil. It's got a lot of minerals, but it's not loamy and rich like the bottomland is that's down the hill from us.
Do you want to explain the listeners what biodynamic means? Because I hadn't heard that term until I started my podcast, and I still don't really know that much about it.
Biodynamics is a really beautiful system. It was started by Rudolf Steiner, who was a scientist and a philosopher. And the thing that appealed to me about it is the approach we have on the farm is you treat your farm, and this goes for if you have a little backyard, if you have plants in your house, you treat everything as if it's a living, breathing entity. So we interact with our farm that way. I did something rather biodynamic when I got cows. You know, I was dreaming about cows and I was wondering about that. And I said, that's the farm telling us we should have cows here again, which was true. But that action is kind of like what you would think of in biodynamics. You know, how do you respect your land? How do you act in concordance with it? How do you do the things that bring this land to its fullest expression of life and vitality? So everything from bringing cows onto the land to making the compost to you treat it with love and respect, and you are always respectful of the spirit of everything. So now, I'm not a normal biodynamic person, and I'll just say that up front because I have some quirky little things that I do that are probably just the nature of me. And one of them is my girlfriend, who also, Patty, has a biodynamic farm 3 hours from me. She laughs. She says, you can't call yourself a farmer because you dig up your weeds and then you go plant them somewhere else. And she said, farmers don't do that. And what I'm responding to is sometimes I'll be working in the garden and I'll see something coming up and I'll go, God, that is the most beautiful, vital, what kind of weed would be a good weed for me to give this example with? Let's say a dandelion. That is the most beautiful mound of dandelion right there. And so I will. I'll dig it up or chickweed or something. I'll dig it up and it looks so alive that I don't want to just throw it in my compost pile. I do. I bring it over somewhere on the periphery of the garden and I usually tuck it back in the ground and say, keep going, grow, have a great time.
Nice. I love all of that.
It just makes it so much fun to interact with the life on the farm in that manner. My husband is like that with the animals on the farm. You know, he just has tremendous respect for what their needs are and how to act with them in such a way that you're always honoring that life spirit that's in that animal.
Now, Rudolf Steiner's the Waldorf guy, right?
Oh, he was an incredible genius. He started Waldorf schools. He actually started the concept for the first CSAs, and that was about bringing people who that didn't have gardens in their backyard, bringing them out to the farm where they would participate in the farmer, with the farmer gardening, and that way they had their hands at least a little bit on the food and had more of an understanding of where their food was coming from and how it was being raised. So the original CSAs were participatory. Some CSAs do that. They have, you know, farm day where you come out and everybody helps do some big project. And other ones are just you pay your money and you trust that it's being done well. Most of them, I think, are. But you don't really get your fingernails dirty. Mm-hmm. So, and he invented anthroposophical medicine and eurythmy, which is a form of movement therapy. And, I could go on and on. The man was just absolutely brilliant. Different kinds of psychotherapy and everything he looked at, he seemed to have an innate understanding of how there was a harmony in all of life. And he worked to bring that out. So biodynamic agriculture was one of the things that came out of him working alongside farmers who were back in about the 20s were looking at the fact that their gardens were for some reason not being as productive as they used to. So he was helping them get back on track.
Mm-hmm. Just as a coincidence, when I grew up, and my mom's house today still is backed up against a Waldorf school. So I just kind of always grew up with that in my backyard. Ooh. Because there was the school and then there was the track and the soccer field. And then there was this nature trail that kind of went around the soccer field. And so our backyard backed up against their nature trail. Mm. And just so I always grew up like, you know, with this gardener back there that took care of their, you know, they had a little garden for the school and then this little nature trail. And there were this really cool grape thing that had like these things you could climb on somehow. And just, I think that always influenced my life was having that little nature trail back there and just that whole school's atmosphere.
Oh, that's wonderful. And kids in Waldorf schools are taught to have a relationship with nature, which is just missing completely in most of the schools today. Although I will say Michelle Obama has been doing a fine job on really promoting that about inner city schools growing their own food so kids understand that a carrot comes out of the ground.
Yeah.
They don't hang on trees.
It's amazing how many kids, like even here in Montana, you wouldn't think that kids that grow up on ranches are surprised that they don't know carrots come out of the ground, potatoes come out of the ground. They think that, you know, that stuff comes from the grocery store shelves.
So. Yeah, and they're surprised it has contact with dirt.
Yeah. I know. I've brought in carrots that Mike's grown to school before for kids for like a bonus snack treat or something. And they're like, this has dirt on it. I need to go wash it off. And it's just funny. But yeah. So do you want to tell us how you got started with the bees? I mean, I guess you told us a little bit about somebody brought you some, but I mean.
Yeah, I've had bees now for, I think this is my 13th year. And I really knew nothing about bees when I started out. I really thought, you know, they slept at night. They did something with pollination, not sure what that was. And You know, there was honey that came out of the hive, and if you got them upset, they stung. That was probably, you know, in 20 seconds, I could tell you the sum total of what I knew about bees back then. And I was, from the first day, I was absolutely fascinated with them. And I used to put on my big old bee suit with, you know, no human skin exposed. And I had duct tape around my sleeves. My boots were duct taped to the legs of the bee suit, and, you know, the big hat and veil and gloves and all that. And I would go down and sit with them. And it was interesting because I sat next to them and just watched and watched. It was swelteringly hot in July when the bees got here. And I realized that, you know, I kind of thought they were going to attack me when I first went out there, which is why I was so suited up. And over time, I realized they didn't care about me one bit. You know, and the longer I sat there, you know, they'd land on my arm, my sleeve, and walk around and look, and then fly over to the hive. And I, right from the start, became aware of their extremely gentle nature. And that surprised me. We so fall prey to what media teaches us about everything, you know, that everything in nature is scary, scary. And, you know, swarms of bees will come and attack. And good Lord, it's not like that at all. My first bees were fairly feral. You know, they'd been out in the woods on their own for many years. And right from the start, that was how I got going. I've always collected swarms, wild swarms, which are honeybees, but they're feral. You know, they're living in trees or somewhere. They've been out on their own. And the nice thing about those beautiful feral bees is they haven't been treated with chemicals, which a lot of beekeepers do. They worry about their bees getting mites or diseases, and they put chemicals on them. And those bees, they're so delicate. You know, I've been reading studies that say if you treat your bees, that it can cause DNA damage for as long as 5 generations past that original colony that you treated. And that's only because the study only went to 5 generations. So that kind of damage, I'm just not into it. I work with wilder hives that are feral and strong and healthy to begin with. I don't do any treatments whatsoever. Nothing at all ever goes into the hive. My bees eat honey. They don't eat sugar. You know, everything's done with respect to the way that nature raises bees. And we have really strong bees. I won't say from the start that all of my bees survived, because they certainly didn't. And over time, my bees, each year they put out another swarm from each hive, and that swarm becomes part of our more bees, and they get more feral, and we continue to treat them that way. We don't do anything that's out of the link with Mother Nature, other than providing them a house. I guess I could say that's a little bit out of it, but I try to provide them houses that let them be bees, rather than trying to always force them into something that is easier for humans to handle bees. And I think that's the cardinal rule about it is, if anything, whenever I hear someone say, well, you know, if you do it this way, it's easier on you to do it this way. And I think, well, that's the rule that I have. If it's easier for humans, it probably means it's not so great for bees. So I'm willing to put up with a little bit more effort on my part to make sure that the bees stay healthy.
So cool. I'm so glad you brought all this up, because we've been wondering about those mites. And I told Mike that he's supposed to do something about these Varroa mites. And he mm-hmm. said that he had seen this video where you can put powdered sugar on them. But
yeah,
you're not even doing that. We don't even have
no.
to do that. Cool.
Well, let me tell you, there is a sequence on this, because if you do, or by the way, that's an organic treatment. So I'm organic, but I'm really an extreme organic in that what you call this group is the kind of stuff that we do is treatment free. And there's quite a big movement in the bee community for treatment free. Powdered sugar makes them groom themselves. And if they have little mites, which are like bee fleas, then they'll groom them off. That's the theory. But God, they hate that stuff. They're meticulously clean in their hive. And when you dump powdered sugar in there and make them clean everything up, it's just a mess. It's like someone walking into your bedroom and boom, you know, throwing a whole bunch of powdered sugar around. Ack. You know, your house will probably be clean afterwards, but at what cost? So, and then you have to keep on doing it. It doesn't cure anything. But it is one step better than miticides, which are chemicals that kill the bee, kill the mites, but also weaken the bees. And they do show that there are effects where the bees become weaker after the miticides consistently. There are studies that are showing that. We are treatment-free, which means I have this concept that I follow, which is that Mother Nature, the way she works throughout everything in the world, is that the strongest ones survive and the weak ones die. Well, we've done so much funky bee breeding with the bee community. You can buy bees. They're called a package. You order a package and it comes in the mail, and they're bred in ways that I don't agree with. They're bred like sometimes with artificial insemination, which isn't certainly the male drone bee catching up to this beautiful queen and impregnating her because he was the strongest, fastest, you know, and he had good genes. This is just in package situations. It's just the next drone on the line, the assembly line, that his sperm is put into her to, and they're often all from one line. A queen bee can breed in the wild with, 12, 15, 20 different daddies, and that gives that hive a wide variety of traits in the babies that will allow them to, it will allow them to respond to nature's different situations. So if part of the bees in that hive, you have a drought, and then you have some bees with the daddy that knows all about drought behavior, those bees go, oh, don't worry about it. We know exactly what to do. First of all, we're going to do this. Then we're going to do that. And they'll show the other bees. And you have variety in there so that everybody has different skills and talents. And that's the beauty of wild mated bees, is that you could have 20 different daddies with 20 different genetic lines and beautiful behaviors that may get called on during the life of that colony. So what I do, to get back to what I was saying there about nature is always looking for what's strong and that survives, and what's weak, and let's take that out of the gene pool. So when you start out with bees, there's a good chance that your bees won't survive because we've weakened the gene pool so much. And I can tell you, my first 4 years, none of my bees survived. It wasn't until year four that my first bees actually made it one whole year right through the winter. And that was heartbreaking to me, but I was committed to sticking to letting the bees do it on their own. So I collected each year a few new swarms and let them go and let them go on my land in a hive. And eventually it sort of worked its way out. Now I have way more success with bees. Occasionally I lose a hive, but the vast majority of my bees do survive. And they've been doing it on their own. So you're a first-year beekeeper. Don't be surprised if you lose bees in your first year, or two or three even. And that's okay. What that means is those were bees that were weak, and they can drop out of the gene pool. I do believe that's what Mother Nature's asking us to do. Let the weak bees die off and let the strong bees survive. So treatment-free is part of that process. And, starving to death, well, that's a different thing. You know, yes, I would feed a hive in the wintertime that was starving. But as far as treatments, no, I don't do anything like that.
So you don't worry about those varroa mites getting spread?
No. And, you know, the thing about it is I taught beekeeping down in Dominican Republic a few years ago. And there were beekeepers down there. And of course, they have mites too. And I was working with the very, very rural beekeepers way up in the mountains. It was, 5 hours driving through SUVs through rivers and things like that to get up there. And it was quite interesting. Many of them were also, not all of them, but many of them were also quite poor. And they had people come through to teach them their methods of beekeeping before, and they were telling them, buy these chemicals, put them on your bees, and and do it every year, do it prophylactically. And so I asked the very poor ones that were way back in the mountains, I said, how are your bees doing? And they said, oh, they're doing okay. And I said, they said, well, we want to confess to you, we haven't been using those chemicals. And of course they hadn't. Their annual income was like $1,000 a year. They're certainly not going to go out and spend $30 on bee chemicals. And so I said, well, how are your bees doing? They said, oh, the bees are fine. And that was really interesting because they had stopped using the chemicals and the bees became stronger. The bees were surviving without losses over the winter, which I thought was fascinating. What we're actually asking Mother Nature to do, what we're asking the bees to do, is when the strong ones survive and the weak ones die off, that affects your gene pool. So as we let those weak hives drift off into death, you're left with stronger and stronger bees. And you don't have to be 100%. I've had years where I've had no mites whatsoever on my bees, which is fabulous. I've also had years where I've had mites. I've had about 3 years ago, I had a hive that got deformed wing virus, which is a mite. It's a disease that comes from the mites. And oh, it was such a good hive. And I said, okay, you guys, you're on your own here. I'm not going to put chemicals on you. And it was really interesting. The first thing they did was they started bringing out the little baby bees that had deformed wings, and they were flying them off and dumping them out into the grass. And they'd come back and they started cleaning out all of the brood, which is the baby bees, the eggs, and the mites hatch inside that egg cell. And they were taking out everything that was damaged. And I realized, you know what? They're going to make it. They're doing the proper behavior. They're saying, something is contaminating our brood. We need to get rid of it. So they cleaned out all of that brood. And it took them a few months. And then all of a sudden, there was no more mites. There was no more deformed wing virus. It can take a few months for them to handle that. And it might even take a year or two. And it might also be that they come to an agreement with how many mites they can handle. You know, it wouldn't be unusual to see in a treatment-free beekeeper's bee yard, that they have some mites. They just don't have weak bees. They have strong bees, so that a small amount of mites they can actually deal with. So that's my experience with it. I've had that happen in our bee yard a few times now, and I trust it. Every once in a while, a hive will go, it's too much for us. We can't handle it. And then they go down. They die. But the majority of them who've had to handle that have come out the other side, stronger bees.
Okay, so another question I had, I didn't even like the whole how do you count the mites thing, because it seemed like you had to kill a bunch of bees just to figure out how do you know if you have mites or whatnot then?
Well, you can see them on your bees. And generally, I the first time I saw one coming into that hive was I was just sitting outside watching them land on the landing board. And I saw a drone land, the bigger bees, the boys, and it had a mite on it. And I was, I haven't seen mites in quite some time. And, you know, it's hard to have completely mite-free bees if you're anywhere near other bees. And bees will go up to 2 miles or more when they're looking for stuff. So your bees can catch mites from other bees. Right now, we just finished the almond pollination that goes on down in California. Mm-hmm. And during this time in February, there are about, I think it's 85% of all the bees in the United States are in the almond fields doing the pollination right now. They have to go there because it's a monoculture. There's nothing else for bees to eat, so bees couldn't even survive there in July. There's nothing to eat. So they hire all of the people, the conventional beekeepers, the commercial ones, who bring their bees, transport them on trucks down there, let them pollinate for a few weeks, and then head off to wherever the next monoculture is calling them. So from there, they'll, for example, come up to Washington and do apple blossoms, or out to Minnesota and do blueberries. And they've just come from the fields in Florida before that, where they were doing citrus. And this monoculture thing is just devastation to bees. When you bring all these bees into one area, it's like a big bee brothel. Any disease anybody's got, the other bees are all mingling together, and then you turn around and drive them out to another state. When mites first came into the United States, it was in Florida. about, I think about 15 years ago. And that was during the time when all the commercial beekeepers had their bees in the citrus fields down in Florida. And so they then took them out to the almond fields and then off to the different states for the different monoculture pollinations. And at the end of that 1 year, there were mites in all 48 of the continental United States. You couldn't have designed a system better to carry that stuff all over the whole country. Isn't that unbelievably amazing?
That's
we did it ourselves.
Crazy that we've mm-hmm. come down to that, no less.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we just don't worry about the mites. And if our bees survive, they survive. And if they don't, we have to get different bees.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the big hints on that is not to buy packaged bees. Buy your bee. If you're going to get started with bees, get your bees from somebody who you know, who does good, organic, healthy bee care. So we have people around us who do that. They raise nooks of bees with queens and a small amount of bees to get started. Or we have other people who catch swarms and will catch a swarm for somebody. And that's how we start them out. So we're not doing part of that artificial insemination and making what they call emergency queens, which are queens that are not quite as down healthy as natural queens are. And that's a whole nother one. So I'm not going to go into too much detail on that. But the secret of it is using good swarms and letting them have all of the wild bee behavior that bees have and not stopping them from doing the things that bees want to do, like swarming. That's how bees make another new hive. They send the old queen out with all of the mature bees and they go find another place to build a new hive and start over. And they leave behind baby queens and young bees to take over the old hive. And all of a sudden, boom, you got two beehives now. That's a natural process and it's very, very healthy for bees.
Cool. We for a long time, I mean, we would have got bees years ago if we could have found a local person with bees mm-hmm. that would share bees or help us get started. And just, I had the hardest time doing that, but maybe we just have to look a little further.
There's getting to be more and more people now who are doing treatment free. And if you look on Facebook for treatment free groups with bees and, you know, newsletters, I have a newsletter that I put out that tells, you know, every month, what are we doing with our bees? And people who teach classes, we teach classes here at our farm. There's plenty of people doing really good work with bees these days. I'm just absolutely tickled with where we've come in the last 5 years. Because when I started out, you know, I had an organic farm. I certainly wasn't going to put chemicals on my bees. That didn't make any sense to me. But it was really hard to find out how to take care of bees. And it seemed like I knew there were other people, but I didn't know how to connect with them 13 years ago. Now there's more books out. Even Idiot's Guide to Beekeeping it's the funny name, but it's by Dean and Laurie, Dean Steglitz and Laurie. Oh, I'm going to mispronounce her back name. Herschel Beimer. Nope, I'm not even going to try. Laurie with a long last name. And that's a great like beginner book on treatment-free, getting started with bees. And then I have a book, The Song of Increase, that is about more, it's more about how to be with your bees. I'm what I call a relational beekeeper. I'm not a volume beekeeper. I'm not in it for just the honey. I'm really in it to provide bees the best home I possibly can, the best surroundings I can. And that's where a great deal of the satisfaction for me comes from having my bees. And of course, if you're going to be a beekeeper, you have to be a gardener because you got to feed those bees. It's one of the things I'm always kind of harping on about people who get bees is, you know, you can't just put bees in your backyard and then say, okay, this go to my neighbors and go feed yourself. You wouldn't get any other animal and do that. You wouldn't do that with a dog. You wouldn't say go forage for yourself.
Or water is the other one. Don't go. Because that was like one of ours was because we have such a shortage of water at our place. Like one of the first guys I talked to, he said we were too far from the creek. He wouldn't put any of his hives on our property.
Exactly. And so you have to do water stations.
Yeah.
We had the very first bees that I got. I didn't know that. And making a water station is really important. Now, you know, when we go collect swarms with people, I always ask them, okay, is your hive is set up before we get the swarm, right? And they go, yes. And I say, and how about your water station? Ooh, got to go do that. A water station is on day one, when you bring those bees home, they will go and find a source of water. And it may be your neighbor's swimming pool, which isn't so keen, you know, it's not such a great idea. And that's what I did. My neighbor said, you must have just got bees. And I said, yeah, how did you know? He said, because they're all in my swimming pool drinking water. So really? I had to very quickly go, build. And now we have a whole bunch of water stations all over the place. And
do you want to tell listeners like how they create a water station and like, are there important things? Like, do you have to make sure that there's a place for them to stand, like rocks or something, so they won't drown?
Oh, Jackie, I'm so glad you asked me that. That's great.
Okay.
You can, even if you don't have bees, you can still provide water for them. And it's not just the honeybees, but also the native bees will come, and butterflies will come, and dragonflies. Everybody will come to your water station. What we do is we take, the most typical thing I do is take a bird bath. So let's say you've got a concrete or even a plastic bird bath in your backyard, and you get one of those. Now, you don't want it to be like for birds. You would leave that whole thing open water. And that's nice, but that's not what your insects need. The bees need to have a place where they can drink the water without falling in and drowning. So what we do is, the easiest thing is just fill it with gravel halfway and then put water so that there's mounds of gravel that are taller than the water. And the bees can land on that mound of gravel and walk down and stick their long little tongue down in there and get some water. You can do it. I live in the Pacific Northwest, which is the home of all the moss. So I don't use gravel. I actually just make little mounds of moss that fell off the trees and put them in there. And my bees can walk down the side and take their little drinks. My girlfriend's Robin, she and her partner live down in Portland, and she has the most beautiful bee watering stations. Her partner has, they sell crystals, and so they got these bird baths and they turned them into crystal and moss watering stations for the bees. And they are just exquisitely beautiful. So she's made them like centerpieces in her garden where all of the local insects are coming for their water needs. And they're just gorgeous to look at. Beautiful, beautiful.
Mike built this like pond, and it's supposed to like, the water is supposed to like, I don't know, go somehow, like there's like this 40-foot creek, or not even 40-foot, maybe 20-foot, like fake kind of creek with rocks and, you know, plastic thing. And it grew all the moss, and that's where the bees totally hang out. By that moss.
If you have a little like a fountain or something that's doing that and moving water, that's great. Right, and they'll come onto the side.
Yeah.
Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
And they'll come onto the side of it and they'll stick their tongues out. We have stock tanks because we have, you know, cows and other big animals around. And in the stock tanks, I noticed that some of my bees were going to try and drink water out of that. And I went, oh gosh, they're falling in. So I put sticks in there, just floating sticks. And then one day I was watching, feeling so proud of myself that, you know, I put sticks in the tank and the bees weren't falling in. And I saw a bee trying to climb up onto the stick, and they were just doing like log rolling. And the little stick kept twisting around. And so now I have forked sticks in all of the stock tank. And my husband always says, do we really need to have all these sticks in the cow water? Like, yeah, we do. We do. And that way, if a bee lands on it, it can walk down to the edge and the stick is very stable in the water.
Because it just has like a little ending on it where it forks so that it doesn't roll.
Yeah. So it can't roll.
Oh, and the bees. Cool.
And I've gotten calls from people before who said, you know, there's a swarm of bees in my backyard. There was a elderly woman who lived about 10 miles from here, and she called me, and I went out to collect the swarm. And lo and behold, she had this beautiful water feature with the little fountain in it and a little pond and water lilies. And it was absolutely filled with bees. And it wasn't a swarm. It was that I could see there was a beekeeper who lived, maybe a tenth of a mile from her. I could actually see across the fields to where his hives were, but he wasn't providing them water. And they were all in her backyard because she was the water station. So I told her she needed to go talk to him and tell him he's a beekeeper. He needs to provide water for his bees so that they're not in her backyard. So that was interesting. But if you're a beekeeper, handle that water station. Make sure you've got it out there for them. It's really important. Every day they need to have water.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, Mike, and I told him we need to plant more chives this year because the chives are like one of the first things to bloom. And I know the bees love to go on the chives. Oh, that's what I was thinking. So usually we get a lot of bumblebees that are different than our bees. So then
They're all important. The bumblebees have a longer tongue so they can pollinate and get nectar. They get the nectar from different kinds of plants, but their size will help them pollinate different kinds of flowers as well. And I'm so glad you brought that up about the having the different kinds of bees around, because those native pollinators, they're really important. One of the things we do in our garden, and all gardeners should do this, I'm just going to make a blanket statement on that, is let everything that once it grows out from being your food, like your broccoli, for example, let some of the broccoli heads go and then they'll flower. And of course, you want to be saving seed anyway. So when they flower, these plants that you grow in your garden as vegetables, you will not believe how beautiful they are as flowers. This is more like a radish seed fell somewhere and grew on its own. I really had very little to do with it. But I had this radish coming up and I let a bunch of them go to flower. And it was 4 feet tall and almost 5 feet wide. And it was completely covered in white flowers every day, probably bloomed for at least a month. And people would come into my garden, my vegetable garden, and go, "What is that? You know, what kind of flowering bush is that?" I said, "That's a radish."
It's so true.
If you let lettuce go, people don't realize lettuce will grow 6 feet tall and it will be 4 feet wide, one lettuce plant, and it will have these beautiful blue flowers. It's a member of the chicory family. And these blue flowers, the radish flowers and the lettuce flowers, the bees love them. I let lettuce go every spring. I let some of them go all the way, and they will bloom and bloom and bloom. They'll bloom until the frost kills them back. And you would, if you were a flower grower, you should know about this because they make the most beautiful flowers in your garden. You know, I can plant a head of lettuce and it turns into a 6 foot tall, 4 foot wide blue flowering bush that will go till frost. Wow, that's a lot of bang for your buck.
I love it. Awesome. I'm going to have to let some of my lettuce grow. I've let things grow. We let
Everything
a lot of things
does.
Grow last year because we've been learning a lot about saving our seeds. So we
let
a few more things grow than usual. But
yep, if you let your kale go or your bok choy or anything, just let it go and see what it turns into and see if the bees are interested. It's just marvelous.
Okay, so let me ask you a few questions that I typically ask, like, is there an activity that's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Like something that you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
My most favorite activity is watching the bees on my flowers. Everything that's flowering in there, I can spend hours out there. And we beekeepers call that bee time. Because I'll tell you, I'll be making a salad and I'll say, "Oh, I'll be right back. I'm just going to run up to the garden and clip a few lettuce leaves." And I'll be back like an hour later. And everyone will be looking at me like, "Where have you been?" And well, I haven't been gone that long, have I? And I just get sucked right into it. You know, too, because you're laughing. I can hear you. You know that. So we call it bee time. Oh, look at what she's got. She's got pollen that's purple. Where is the purple pollen? And then I'm looking around and I see somebody else and good Lord, did really 45 minutes just fly by?
I know it well. And I'm usually out there with my camera too. I get sucked into taking pictures of them. How about something though that you have to force yourself, like your least favorite activity, like something really like to do? Anything you got to force yourself to do?
Pulling things out. I am so bad at that. I am just the world's worst weeder because, like I said earlier, I look at him and I go, "Ooh, you have so much vitality and life force, and maybe I'll just let you stay right where you are." So I think I'm I'm saying now, I've named it into, oh, I'm just a farmer who mulches with weeds. That's it. And I don't necessarily pull them up. I let them grow right alongside. That's kind of a permaculture concept, too, is that,
that's,
you know,
what
I'm not.
Thinking.
Yeah, it's not really, that's what I can call it. But really, the truth behind it is, I just hate pulling out something that's growing, that's alive. I have more of a curiosity about, let's see how you do if I leave you right here. If they start to take over something that I planted, then I'll probably pull back some of them. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, no. And the other thing is, this is between my husband and I, because he takes care of the pastures for the animals, we have things like, thistle. And thistle, hey, when it's thistle, when it's seed, it's a great bird food. But, oh man, thistle, when it blooms, is a beautiful flower that bees totally love. It's really healthy for them. So we sort of have this ongoing thing where he'll say, well, this thistle's over here. I'm going to pull them out. And I go, no, just let them flower first. And then I say, don't you pull them out. I'll cut them back after they flower. Just leave them go. So it is kind of a funny thing because I will let them go till the last possible second.
Well, isn't the true definition of a weed something that's growing where you didn't tell it to? So if you want it to grow there, it's not really a weed anyway.
Yeah.
That's always my theory. So, I'm always like, this isn't
a weed.
I
like that.
Those daisies are not really weeds. Don't be mowing down my daisies.
I work so much better within that framework. And, you know, I believe, too, that weeds are bringing something to the soil. And I think that's a piece that a lot of people don't understand and that we're not taught. You know, the job of the weed is to carry something into the soil or to do something, like a dandelion, for example. When we first moved here, my house in the front yard was filled with dandelions. And my neighbor across the street one day said to me, and I know what she was intending me to do. She said, you have a lot of dandelions in your front yard. And I know she was saying, and when they go to flower and seed, they're all going to be in my pristine yard that has not one dandelion. So that first year, and this was the early days of my farming, I dug out as many dandelions as I could. I must have dug out 1,500 dandelions.
Oh my
gosh. And then the next year, it didn't make a bit of difference. There were 2,000 dandelions in my front yard. So after I dug them all up, and they all came back again. Well, by this time we had chickens. So we had put our chickens down in that same area and that became part of the broad chicken area. And then of course we were starting to put compost around and things. Now the job of a dandelion is to send down this long taproot. It's a miner. It's mining the soil for calcium and it sucks it up in its long taproot and brings it up to the surface through its leaves and its flowers. And then when that plant dies back, it deposits that little contribution of calcium in the soil. So it's seeking to rebalance it. Now, the difference is in nature's time, that may take, 40 years or 10 years. It doesn't matter. Nature's not on a clock like we are. We look out there, though, and we say, that shouldn't be there, and I'll go pull that out, or I'll spray something on it to kill it. And yet, it has a task to do. So over the last few years, the longer we've been here and the more we've kind of added things to that soil by the chickens pooping on it and by us spreading compost around, we don't have dandelions in the front yard anymore, which kind of makes me sad because dandelions are a fabulous bee food. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, we should be cultivating dandelions. They're the first sign of spring food for a bee. That's when dandelions bloom, we say that's the official start of bee season. But the dandelions have gone around to the north side of my house and they've started to do some work over there. But they're, you know, like I said, they're miners. They have a task. Everything does. My soil is clay. And that thistle I was talking about, the thistle's job is to send down a taproot and then make a big fat taproot so it actually breaks open the soil and allows places where air can get into that tight, compacted clay soil. And when that thistle dies back and the root rots, all of a sudden we have air holes down there. So it's improving the soil. We just, you know, we aren't often aware of what the task of the weed is, or we would be praising them and saying, you know, more, come on over here.
I wonder if I can come up with a good task for spotted knapweed to be praising, because that's what we have to deal with.
Well, I can tell you on the other side, spotted knapweed used to be responsible for why Montana was the number one bee growing place in the whole U.S.
Really?
It's that spotted knapweed. And it's a bane to everybody else, but it's a wonderful flower for bees. So maybe you just need to become more of a beekeeper and then you have it for good purpose.
Really?
I know it is for invasives. Yes, I had a friend who was from Tennessee who bought land in Montana, and he was going to retire up into Montana and do his bees up there. He was a beekeeper in Tennessee. And he went out there 2 years ago, and he said that the beekeepers were in lament about the fact that the everybody was doing such a good job on the spotted knapweed, and there was starting to be so much less of it, which was actually hurting the honeybee population. You probably hadn't known that part, right?
No, when I was just like telling Mike we should put this up here where the spotted knapweed is right by the bees and plant this some other thing so we could like overrun the knapweed. But the knapweed's good for the bees, huh?
I don't know what it does in terms of the soil. There's probably something, but it's not a weed I have over in my area, so I'm not as familiar with the good purpose that it has, because everything has good purpose. You just have to look at it from a different direction sometimes. But it's a wonderful thing to look at weeds and see that and go, you know, they're doing something wonderful here, and I need to be respectful of the tasks that they have. They're actually trying to help. And they're doing a great job at it, too. Whenever what happens, though, is we get out of balance with things. And that's where things go awry. So people would look at, oh, dandelions, I should get that Monsanto product out here and spray everything and kill it. And it's like, please don't do that. It's the soil. It's always the soil. You always go back to that. If the soil is unbalanced, nature will send in weeds to handle it. Nature will send in moles to run, or voles to run around under the soil and loosen it up, and plants that will do the appropriate balancing with it. We humans are the interlopers. If we weren't here, there would be an ongoing sense of balance through all of nature.
I like that. Absolutely.
So that's really our task. We need to learn how to work with nature and support and supplement and be respectful of what the tasks that she's trying to do are.
Do you have some gardening advice? Like, what's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
What a good question. The best gardening advice I've ever received. Well, gardening with nature. I think that's the difference. You know, when I started out on my own, bumbling around, not knowing I had to water radishes when I was 10 years old, all the way up to, you know, planting stuff and thinking that I had to do it separate from nature. I think that was how I started with raised beds. You know, oh, you just put the bean in here and it goes into a bean, and that's all that's growing in this bed. Now I'm much more aligned with, we need to have a mix of things in here. Nature doesn't have monocultures, even if they're little monocultures in your garden. And that said, yes, I do have I do have beets growing in one of my areas. But I've also done it where I've taken all my seeds, mixed them in a big jar, and just made a 100-foot swath. And I have two swaths, 100-foot and an 80-foot swath on my hillside, where I just took everything that was left over from the year and sprinkled it in and said, well, let's see what this does. And that was the most fun garden I have ever had. Everything was growing. You could just walk down the row and pick everything you wanted for dinner that night. It was a little lettuce here and a little bit of kale over there and a turnip. And look at this. We've got some corn coming up. And it was all kind of corn, I know, has to be all together. But nonetheless, this was my end of the year, what am I going to do with the seeds left over thing. It was way fun. It was just this, I just saw this bounty of everything growing up. You know, the corn grew up, but then, you know, you do that three bean thing where the beans are growing up, the three sisters thing, mm-hmm. where the the beans are growing up and the squash are walking out. And it was like that, but on a grand scale with everything mingled together. That was so much fun, so much fun. And I do it year after year now because it lets me spread whatever's left over that I didn't get a chance to plant and see what happens.
Nice. I think that sounds fun and exciting and kind of like an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
What about you? Do you have a tool? Like, is there a favorite tool that you like to use? Or if you had to move, there's only, you could only take one tool with you. What would you not leave behind?
What is that knife called? Is Kirikiri knife?
A hori hori.
Hori hori. Thank you. Yes. Which a friend of mine who speaks Japanese said means knife.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's the knife. And that, I got that just a few years ago and I love it. It goes, you know, hangs right off my belt loop and it does everything. You know, you can poke with it, you can cut with it, you can dig something up with it. That's my favorite hand tool. But my favorite big tool is the old scythes, the old fashioned scythe.
Oh, uh-huh.
Oh man, we love using that. And we can take down big areas when we're doing like haying. I can hay around the edges and that's so much fun. And the other thing we have is, oh gosh, I've forgotten the name of it now. It's that big tool. It's as tall as me. And you fling it down into the ground. It's got a whole bunch of tines.
A broad fork?
Yes. Thank you. That thing, my husband and I will go, no, I'll do that. You can, no, I'll do that. It's okay, honey. I'll do that one. And we just have so much fun flinging it into the dirt and jumping on the top of it and rocking it back and forth and loosening up the dirt with the broad fork. That's just a heck of a fun time. And I used to do all of that by hand and it took us absolutely forever. And I was always, and then when I got a rototiller and I started rototilling, I was going, oh my God, I'm killing all my worms. And that didn't feel good. So when we got the broad fork many years ago, that loosening up the soil and the composition of the soil, the different layers stay intact. The insects that are down in the soil, they don't get harmed. That made me really happy. I like that tool a lot.
Yep, we're going to get one of those this year. After talking to all my guests this year, I said, I got to get you one of these. How come we don't have one? I'm surprised that we don't have one. But
yeah, one of our friends made one. He was a welder and he made one and he brought it and he traded us for it. And we were like, huh, that's an interesting tool, until we started using it. And we felt the same way. Why have we never gotten one of these before?
Yeah. That's been recommended by a lot of people. I'm thinking the hori hori knife, maybe, because doesn't it have like kind of a serrated edge on one side?
Yep.
I mean, and so maybe that's why it's like serrated knife, the other knife in Japanese, the knife, because it's like two different kinds of knife in one.
And you can pull up things, you can dig up stuff, you can, it's got 10 different tasks that you can do with it. And that was so much better than me with my dangling bucket of, 10 tools. I just don't need to have that many of them with me now. So I just tie it on and off we go.
Oh, I like that. Okay. Do you have a favorite recipe you like to make from the garden?
Oh, I think I could live on saute a bunch of garlic in a little bit of oil and then throw in about 9 pounds of kale and sprinkle it with sesame seeds and some aminos or tamari. I think I could live on that. That would be me on a desert island. I could only take one food. That's it. And you see, I didn't even have to hesitate to tell you what my favorite thing to eat is.
Cool.
I can eat that year round. I live in the Northwest where I actually can have a garden through the winter. And I can't grow tomatoes in the winter, obviously. Even in my greenhouse, they wouldn't work there. But I can grow greens all year round. And I can go out right now. In January, I can go out and pick chard and some of my more bitter lettuces and cress and kales and even the beet greens, all of those things. They just make it right through the winter. And I'm not talking about in the greenhouse. I can grow those outside.
Nice. So that's why you moved from New England, huh?
No, I wasn't a gardener back then, remember? That was one of the things where I went, oh, now I know why I moved. My inner longing to become a gardener and farmer is being served by this, and I just didn't even know I had that longing back then.
Excellent. How about a favorite internet resource?
internet resource.
Anywhere you find yourself on the web frequently?
Well, I have really wonderful connections on Facebook. And we have, in my area, I have my farm girls group is on that. We're farmers. You know, we don't get to go socialize and go into town and have a cup of tea somewhere. I find that being on Facebook, it brings us all together in a way that's really wonderful. And I'm on a number of groups that are like treatment-free beekeeping and different aspects of whatever we're doing in our life. I really feel very served by that. It's wonderful. My farm gals group, we've done a few things that I think are really interesting. One of them is we formed a buying group, and we buy stuff in bulk, and we buy big stuff in bulk. You know, my husband bought 400, he had to buy 400 T-posts. T-posts are expensive. So we went in, we just said, who in the group needs to buy some T-posts? So we went in and did a group order and got a significant discount on it because we were ordering hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of T-posts. It was everyone who's in my buying group. I think we have probably about 100 women. And we put, if anybody needs anything, we just did a chocolate buy, organic chocolate, but at a price that you really want to pay rather than what you'd buy it off the shelf in the store as an impulse buy at. We buy everything that way now. And I would say probably 85% of what I buy through my farm gals buying group. And I'd encourage other people to set them up because you get together a good group of people and then you can go to a supplier and say, coconut oil, if we buy it in 5-gallon buckets, how many do we have to buy to get a great wholesale price? And wholesale is like, sometimes it's half off, sometimes it's a third off, but it's still significant. You know, if I'm buying nuts, we do a bulk buy. And we just bought pecans and hazelnuts and what was the other kind? And another kind of nut, walnuts. And we bought them all really at a heavy, heavy discount.
Oh my goodness. That's got to be one of the best, if not the best, internet resource anybody has said. Huh. And I love it for two reasons, because I love Facebook and I hate that people say negative things about Facebook. And so here's another great solution. And then if you knew how much money I spend on walnuts, I got to find a local buyer's group here because my husband's a baker. And so walnuts.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, we go through a lot of walnuts.
Yeah, and I buy an annual amount.
And turbinado sugar, I bet, would be another one we could get. Because I spend a fortune on sugar at the health food store. It's just crazy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we buy everything we buy. I think virtually everything we buy is organic. So that takes off the argument about, oh, it's organic, it costs too much. Well, not when you're buying through a buying group. You'd be surprised how many things. And you could get together a group of your girlfriends. If you got together 10 of them, and said, let's just look this up. So we run it that somebody will say, I need to get whatever it is we can't grow. Or even we do our seed buys the same way. You know, I need to get some of this. And then that person will take over doing that particular buy. And then she'll just make up a little Google Doc sheet that says, here's what we're buying. Here's what the price is. Who wants how many of what? And even in the springtime, we even do starts that way. You know, not everybody is going to start everything from scratch. And it's a time saver. So someone will say, I'm going to go do squash starts. And she'll either start them her own on her own self and sell them to us. Or it will be somebody who I bought a bunch of melon starts to use in my greenhouse. And what was nice was I didn't have to buy a whole bunch of seed packets of all different kinds. I bought 16 different kinds of melons to put in my big greenhouse, and I just bought a few of each of them. And at the price at the volume that we bought, we got a wholesale price from the nursery that started them for us.
Nice. That is awesome. What a great resource. I'll bet listeners are going, I had no idea. And
I think it's the wave of the future.
Like, you know, we have
it's the
like
wave of
local...
the future. This is, I think this is the way that we're going to be doing a lot of stuff. It's, it builds community. We all help each other out. And even when we go to pick up our stuff at that person's house,
that's what I was gonna say.
Someone will call me up and say, you know what? I'm heading out that way. I'm going to go get it. And I'm going to go right past your house. So why don't I pick up yours and I'll drop them off on the way home. So we do this for each other all the time too. One time I was sick with something and my girlfriends knew that I was, and it was so nice. One of them came by and helped me in the house that day, and the next one brought me some food, and the next one, she looked out in my little greenhouse and she said, you have all these tomatoes and they're not in the ground yet. And so she went up and planted probably about 60 of my tomatoes for me. That's what I think groups like that do. They start to say, you know, we don't have to do all this on our own. Let's help each other out. It's funny, you're interviewing me today and it's International Women's Day.
I was just going to say that.
and here my friend Katie talking about it.
has this hashtag going, it's hashtag BizWomanRock. And it's like, why do businesswomen rock? And that's why, because they care for each other and they help each other and they work in a state of cooperation and just...
I would never have called up my girlfriend Alyssa and said, Alyssa, come over here and plant my 60 tomatoes. I don't feel well today. But when she found out I was ill that day, she said, oh, these need to go in the ground. It won't take me that long. And she left her kids at somebody else's house, came out and did it. And when I was better the next day, I walked through my greenhouse going, wow, what amazing girlfriends I have. And this is how we do it. We all support each other.
And that's what I was going to say. I'm sure she didn't just do that because it was, I'm sure that you've helped her and it's a, like a mutual relationship
yep.
that your whole group has, you know, and mm-hmm. just, but the other thing I was thinking.
We held a bee conference last summer. We held a 3-day bee conference every summer in August. And I had some people who were tenting and they needed to have breakfast. And I said, well, you know, you have a farm. Why don't you let them tent on your farm? And she made him breakfast and she charged him a reasonable amount of money. But she told me what a difference it made for her income that month for just that little extra thing. So, yeah, there's always some way we're always kind of looking around going, who could be helped by this?
Yeah. I was thinking you were going to say that when you go to pick the stuff up, it's like a great fun get together.
Well, there's that, too. Sometimes it's like, no, I'll go anyway.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And a chance to, you know, see each other that you wouldn't see each other, but you're seeing each other because you need to go to that thing. And so then you get to go, you know, where you wouldn't see each other. To me, that's what Facebook has done for me. I know I see my friends more when they're on Facebook because we'll, you know, message each other or, you know, mm-hmm. they'll see something I post and they'll be like, oh yeah, by the way, you want to go for a walk today? Or, hey, you want to play tennis today? Or do you want to do this today? Or just,
well, you know, one of the things that it's made really nice for me, and just exactly what you're talking about, even in terms of like what we grow, you know, we used to do farmers market years ago, and I don't do farmers market anymore because everything that I'm growing, my women's group, my buyers, my farm gals group is going to buy it. So I'm never going to get past my driveway with it. And it's really nice for me because I can say, you know what, I got 40 pounds of tomatoes in a basket. I just picked them. It's more than I can do something with today, but it's not enough to take to market. So somebody will call up and say, you know, I'll take 10 pounds and, oh, I'll take the rest of the 30. I'll can them. And, you know, that's it. So I don't have to pick out of sequence. I don't have to pick for market. I don't have to pick for sales. I'll just say, today's the day I've got chard. Who wants it?
Nice.
So we've kind of created our own economy that way as well.
Oh, I think listeners are going to love this. Okay, how about a favorite reading material, like a book or a website or a magazine or something?
Let's see. Well, I read Secrets of the Soil, and I loved that book. I was really a new farmer, and that book was out, and we gave it to quite our interns, when we had interns and apprentices coming to work on the farm, that was a book, that was assigned reading. It was like, you know, here, you need to know that there are many, many ways to do many different things. And some of them sound kind of far out, but, you know, read this book and you'll see, you know, why does music make a difference to your plants and all kinds of things like that. It expanded people's horizons. And I really do like it for that. So that's a book I would recommend. And then we read Mother Earth News and Countryside and things like that. We have subscriptions to those. So Those are kind of steady ones in our house. And I like the magazine Ode and Yes Magazine because they're so positive about things that are going on in the world. If you just get on the internet and open up like what's new in the world, you go, oh, we're going down to hell in a handbasket. And I find those four magazines I mentioned, I find them all just so wonderfully supportive of, yeah, let's all go in a good place. Let's go somewhere where we build community and we care about each other and we're making good things happen in the world.
Nice. I've heard of Mother Earth News and Yes Magazine, but I never heard of Countryside or Ode, so I'll have to check those out. Tell listeners a little bit about your book, too, because we kind of touched on it in the beginning, but do you want to tell them a little more about your new book
Sure.
that just came out and what it's about?
Sure. The name of it is The Song of Increase, and it's got a subtitle, which is Returning to Our Sacred Partnership with Honeybees. And it's not like most bee books in that I don't talk about, you know, here's how you raise bees. I have a connection with bees. I speak with them and I hear them speak back. And that came about after years and years and years of hanging out with my bees saying, I really want to help you, but I just don't know what to do. And I would stand there at the hive and I would go, you just need to tell me what to do because I'm willing to do absolutely anything, but I have to know what it is that you need. And so I just started, one morning I was laying in bed and I was just doing this little kind of clear my mind and meditating. I guess you'd call it meditating. It wasn't even formal like that. And I just had this little piece of information come into my head about something about the bees, about something. It was an explanation of why they were doing something. And I never had read that anywhere. I'd never heard it anywhere. And I told my husband, he said, that's interesting. And gosh, that really sounds true. And I wrote it down. And then I got more of those. I got more and more. I guess it's kind of like the book Conversations with God, where I've forgotten his name. The guy that wrote the book said he just kind of got this information that passed along to him. And I guess it's kind of like that. Wherever it came from, it was these conversations with bees where they started explaining what the world was like from their point of view. And it deeply affected my beekeeping. I understand now why I do or don't do certain things because I can see it from the bee's perspective. And that's what I write about. It's a pretty conversational book. It's got the information from the bees, but it's also got how I learned stuff from them. So if you're someone who is an open-minded beekeeper, you may enjoy it. If you're a very conventional beekeeper and obviously very, you know, I'm not going to do something unless science tells me to do it, it probably isn't your cup of tea. But for people who want to learn more about what the world looks like from the bee side, definitely be your cup of tea. My book is out right now. It's been out for a year. It just got picked up by a publisher, which is really quite wonderful. I self-published it to start, and the sales have done consistently so good. I've been on Amazon's top 100 list in three different categories, and every day I'm on at least one of them and usually two and sometimes three of them. So it caught the eye of a few publishers who asked if they could promote the book as with them being the publisher. So an interesting thing is that when you do that, I actually have to take it off the market for a little bit before it comes back out with them. So it's on the market on Amazon right now, The Song of Increase. It will go off market in May. And then it will come out with a different cover and they'll come out promoting it in September 1st. So if you want it, you kind of have to buy it like now.
That's okay. Listeners are going to want to go out and buy it. It sounds like a great Earth Day book or a great, it sounds like a wonderful read. I'm going to get it for my husband right away because he is definitely a convene with my bees type of guy.
Well, if it's after this, if you're listening to this recording and it's after May when it's not on Amazon, then it will be coming out again right around the 1st of September. And the title is slightly different. The title then is Song of Increase, without the word the on the front, Song of Increase, Listening to the Wisdom of Honeybees for Kinder Beekeeping and a Better World. So, but Song of Increase, one way or t'other, you'll be able to find it. It's been absolutely wonderful having this publisher, Sounds True, as my publisher, come out because I was just kind of promoting it on Amazon, and it was doing really, really well. And that was what caught their eye. And now I hadn't been marketing it to bookstores. So places like Barnes & Noble and things like that will start to stock it in the fall. And for them, it's a brand new book.
Perfect. Well, congratulations. And I think it's all because of your hard work and also because you listen to your heart and you listen to the bees.
Oh, you know what? I can mention too, if you'd like to be on my bee newsletter, go to my website, which is spiritbee.com, spiritbee.com. And there's a little link where you can sign up for my newsletter. And I send out videos and pictures and a little whatever we're doing with our bees this month. And I'm always happy to have people come along and see.
Excellent. Okay. So I'm just going to go to my final question because we're at almost 90 minutes already, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Wow, what a question. You know, sometimes there's so much that has to be done that sometimes I feel like, God, I could just spend all day long, every day, day after day, you know, funding different charities that I adore and things like, and educating people. I think two things are my answer to it. My favorite charity is Xerces.org, Xerces.org. And they do a lot of work with pollinators and trying to get poisons taken out of our environment. They're very effective and they're my favorite charity. And then as far as what I would like to see, you know, if you're a gardener or you're a beekeeper or any of this, it almost requires us to also be activists. And I encourage people all the time to educate your neighbors, tell them why they need to not use chemicals. And probably the biggest thing I do on that side, and I encourage everybody to do this too, when people, you're going to laugh at this one. When my husband goes to like Home Depot or Lowe's or something like that, he'll say, do you want to come in? Oh, you bet I want to come in. And I go stand in the chemical section. I go stand over where you buy all the Monsanto products. And
you're
I just
brave.
Look like I'm browsing and I'll see someone come up and they'll pick out something. They'll be looking at this nasty poison. I'll say, oh, what is it that you've got that you're trying to get rid of? And they'll say, oh, I've got moss in my lawn. And then rather than having them buy some crappy thing or broadleaf weed killer, you know, oh, I had a guy who said, I have clover in my lawn. I want to kill the clover. And I said, why do you want to kill the clover? The clover is like a nitrogen fixer. It's like making your soil healthy. He said, what? And I said, yeah, clover is like one of the reasons you have a healthy lawn. You just have to orient your thinking a little bit differently to say, you know, do I want healthy soil? Do I want a healthy yard? Or do I want to put more poisons on it? And it was an interesting conversation we had. He said, well, I thought I was supposed to not have clover in it because that's what the chemical companies tell them. Broadleaf weed killer, get rid of the clover in your lawn. What a stupid idea. Anyway, I try to be as friendly and helpful as possible, looking like just another person who's looking at that same wall, and try to educate people about, you know, the problem that you've got with some weeds or something. It isn't that the weed is wrong. It's that the weed is trying to do a task and maybe you could help it. If the weed is trying to bring calcium where the dandelions are, well, maybe you could help it out by providing a little bit of that. But the problem you've got with something eating your food, like you've got aphids on your lettuce or something, the problem isn't the aphid. The problem is that what people don't understand is the aphid is actually eating weak plants. That's how Mother Nature gets rid of plants that shouldn't be going to provide their seed for the next generation. Mother Nature sends in bugs or pests or diseases to knock down whatever is weak. And, you know, if we could just tell more people that, I think it would really change the whole chemical killing industry. You know, it isn't that you need to spray poisons on your plants to make them look to make your roses look more beautiful. You need to give it better food. You need to give it better nutrition in the soil, and then the plant will be healthy. I have a neighbor who one year she said to me, "Aren't the aphids absolutely terrible this year? They're eating everything in my garden." And her garden is 200 feet from my garden, and I didn't have an aphid in there. And I went over, and she's elderly, and I said, "You know, let me help you with your soil. What you need is you need some compost. I'll bring over a wheelbarrow full of compost, and we'll get this soil in better shape." But that's the difference between weak soil and healthy soil. Weak soil is going to have pests and diseases because Mother Nature doesn't want that plant to go to seed and donate its seed into the gene pool. It's weak seed, so it needs to be pulled out, and that's the job that the diseases and the pests are doing. What a good job they're doing. Yay. Go pests, go diseases, knock down that weak stuff. And once they've done their task, they're not required anymore.
Awesome. You were
yeah,
just,
it's a radical approach.
But no, it's true. And you know, that's been like a basic theme of my podcast. Like so many guests have come on here and talked about it's all about the soil.
It's all about the soil
health. It's all about mm-hmm. the health of your soil. And you can really change things just by paying attention to creating healthy soil.
And yep, step one.
Yeah, that's crazy. I was trying to get rid of the clover. Oh my goodness. So do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Oh, just love Mother Nature. Fall in love with Mother Nature and everything will be just fine. Once you fall in love with Mother Nature, the whole world changes.
Perfect. Tell listeners how to connect with you. Well, we kind of did, but just one more
yep.
time.
Yep, spiritbee.com. That's my website, spiritbee.com. And sign up for my newsletter, and then you are connected to us, and you'll see all the different things that we're doing. And I have some other websites that are right alongside that. My husband's horse school, which is equinenaturalmovement.com for people who are looking for a career with horses. And also our farm has a website too, friendlyhaven.com. And they're all kind of interconnected.
Perfect. People looking for a career with horses. I wonder if my mm-hmm. granddaughter would be into that. She's such a horse fan. She wants to go to Hawaii to become an oceanographer.
But, we'll see. Well, we need more of those too. That's a great idea. We need more of those.
Well,
people
I'm just surprised
wake us up to that.
Because mm-hmm. she's such a bird freak. She knows every single bird nest on our road. Like it's a 2-mile walk down to the highway. And I'll tell you, she can spot every bird nest on the road from here to there and knows where they are. And she's so into birds and things like that. So who knows?
You know, people who have that vision, I am so impressed by them. We had a bee class here about 2 weeks ago and we were standing around and I was showing them something about the bees. And there were about half a dozen pine trees right behind there, literally 20 feet behind there. And this woman in the class looks up and goes, "Oh, look, you have two barn owls up there." I could have stood there for a year and never seen those barn owls because I'm oriented. My vision picks up, oh, bees. I pick up all the bees around here, but I'm not as much a bird person. And she just pointed them out like I couldn't believe I hadn't seen them before. We see what we're oriented to see. And I just find that fascinating that you're that she has that bird nest vision, you know? Mm-hmm. You probably didn't see them when you were walking with her, did you?
I don't see them as much as she does by any means. And I walk up and down that road like every day. And, you know,
yeah.
she's a runner now. She's a track star. So she kind of has been, this last year, she's been running up and down it more. But even since she was a little girl.
Oh, how funny.
I mean, she's always known them. So, yeah. Just amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I knew you were going to be a great guest, but I just didn't realize how just amazing.
Oh, what
fun. I know my listeners are going to just love everything. And so last year, my Earth Day girl was my Earth Day episode was this woman, Heather, who has she does, you know, natural bees and stuff in Olympia, Washington. She has. Like,
oh, I
little,
probably know her.
Heather Wood.
Heatherwood, yes, I do.
Yeah. So she was just lovely that day. So, but mm-hmm. since we're talking on International Women's Day, I'll call that our holiday. And I'll try to get this up right away since your book's coming out instead of kind of putting it in the line of where it goes. I'll try to, maybe it could be my, I'm going to try to have an episode come out this Thursday. I haven't had episodes out since I went back to teaching in, at Thanksgiving. So hopefully if I can get it done tomorrow, they actually called me in the sub already. If I can get it done tomorrow, it'll be out Thursday morning. But I'll try for this weekend for sure.
Awesome. So thank you so much.
Listeners will love it. Well, thank you for sharing everything. I think people are going to be so happy. And Mike and I have, you know, gone back and forth about those mites. And I've been worrying because...
you just let them go. The strong bees will deal with them themselves. And
okay,
if you
and
lose
that,
we're
not spreading mites to other people's hives or anything like that.
Well, you may be and may not be, but don't fall into that argument, because the more of us who can get on the other side of it with clean, healthy bees and treatment-free beekeeping, then and stop importing the bees from other places, the better off everybody's going to be for it. We all need to get on the bandwagon of organics and clean stuff.
Cool. I love it. Well, have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you so much. That was way fun.
Okay, cool. I'm glad, because it's been a long time, I know. All right. Have a great day.
Bye-bye, Jackie.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.